Do you work in public services? Have you and your team made a difference this year? The Guardian Public Services Awards reward innovation and best practice across all public services. If you're making your sector more innovative, efficient, and imaginative, enter now to get the recognition you deserve. For more information and to enter, visit guardian.co.uk/public services awards. The deadline is midnight on Friday, the 12th of July. Terms and conditions apply.
The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. It began as part of the Arab Spring uprising, but 2 years on, the attempted revolution in Syria has become an entrenched civil war. As bloody civil strife mutates into a proxy conflict for regional powers in the Middle East, what is the role of Western politicians, and what obligations do members of the United Nations really have as part of the doctrine of responsibility to protect civilians? Also this week, as Parliament takes its half-term recess, we run about as far away from Westminster as it's possible to get for our fix of parliamentary politics. An election campaign in Australia is gradually grinding into gear, and we hear from Prime Minister Julia Gillard and our new Australia political editor, Lenore Taylor. But joining me here in the studio first, we have The Guardian's esteemed foreign affairs writer, Jonathan Steele, its foreign affairs leader writer, David Hurst, and our political columnist, Martin Kettle. A warm welcome to you all. Now, on the front line in the anti-Assad stronghold of Aleppo, there is a stalemate. Rebels have machine guns and enough bullets for the time being, but they're being pinned down by government air power and seem unable to unite behind a single clear agenda. The European Union has recently agreed to lift the ban on arming rebel groups from the autumn. And in apparent response, Russia's promising to send powerful anti-aircraft missiles to the Syrian government. And there's a growing body of evidence that chemical weapons are being used by loyalist forces. All of this means that hope's fading fast that the peace talks in Geneva next month can do anything to help protect the civilian population in a conflict that's already claimed the lives of an estimated 80,000. Jonathan Steele, if there is to be a political settlement, which is sort of what everyone seems to be saying they want of this conflict, who needs to be round the table and what would they be discussing?
Well, I think the thing that makes it relatively hopeful is that the US and Russia are actually on the same page. It's almost like a throwback to about 20 years ago when there were two superpowers. But Russia is key in this, and so is the US. In fact, they're taking a better position than Britain and France, unfortunately, who seem to be completely siding with the idea of a military solution and supporting the rebels, although they pay lip service to political settlement. The problem now is to get the opposition to go there. They've just held a disastrous six-day conference in Istanbul where they couldn't agree on an agenda for the conference. They couldn't agree on...
They being the rebels?
The rebels. Mm. They couldn't agree who the opposition representatives would be, and they excluded an attempt by one of the most respected secular opposition people, a man called Michel Kilo, from taking part in their delegation and making it a more moderate and reasonable delegation. So that's really crucial. The Assad people, I think, will definitely attend. At what level, it's not yet clear. Probably either the Prime Minister or the Foreign Minister. But the problem is, the big problem is the opposition at the moment.
But if you could get the opposition to identify, you know, who were their leaders and get people from both sides round the table, what would they be talking about? Is there a world where there's some power sharing or where the territory gets split up into Assad and non-Assad areas? Well,
I don't think anybody would agree at this stage formally to say that the country is divided. De facto, you're right, it is divided, and it won't change much. That's why there is no military victory possible for either side. The Assad people will never eliminate all the rebels. It'll have to concede territory, which it's already done, and the rebels, I don't think, can ever win militarily either. No, I think what they've got to work out is the transition mechanism, and that was already in what was called Geneva One, when the US, Russia, and Britain and France actually at that stage agreed to the idea of a transition mechanism to a more democratic and pluralistic Syria. And that would involve, as you said in your question, a coalition. They talked about a transitional government with full executive powers that would include members of the present government and members of the opposition.
And when you say Russia's in a more reasonable position. I mean, that might surprise some listeners because they've heard about Russia sending in this heavy kit, these anti-aircraft missiles to help Assad on the side of Assad, who no one presumably trusts to use them gently. What do you mean by Russia being in a better place?
Well, in the sense that it's been the biggest country that's really been pushing for a negotiated settlement. And it isn't just lip service. I do think they are really worried about the regional spillover, which now the Americans have taken on board as a big issue. And they're not automatically supporting Assad. They've said many times the who runs Syria, the identity of that person is not in our gift. It's up to Syrians to decide that. We're not committed to Assad. They've said all those things in the past. And so I think they have been the real proponents of a political solution, much more than the West has been up till now.
David, Barack Obama stated that concrete evidence of the use of chemical weapons would be a red line, which kind of implies something big will happen if that's confirmed. I mean, it's sort of absolute inverse of the position with Iraq a decade ago. It looks like Washington's being deliberately cautious about what evidence there is, because it's not totally obvious that he's got any options, is it, to use if that red line is crossed? What options does he have? Are there any that he'd actually want to take up?
Well, I think you're right. I think he really does not want to intervene militarily in Syria. I think the whole notion of a red line is an unhelpful one for him and for everyone else. And his administration is split. I mean, I think chaos is a word that we all use rather too much in foreign policy, but the lines in and around the various fault lines are supremely chaotic. I was talking to an opposition leader last night, for instance, who spent the first Syrian opposition leader who spent the first 40 minutes of his discussion basically attacking other opposition leaders in Istanbul and not getting on to the subject of Assad or tens of thousands of dead or this vicious civil war. And it was jaw-dropping the way, as Jonathan has just said, they are divided. So if you got to the stage where Obama's hand was forced, you would have to address the question of on whose behalf are we intervening? And that is the problem, I think, with William Hague's position and also with Laurent Fabius's position in France, that the whole notion of rearming the weapons and the rebels is tied up with the notion of a war on two fronts. Ostensibly, it's a war against Assad, but the justification now for giving the rebels more arms is to increase the space for so-called pro-Western rebels that has now been adopted by jihadis or Islamists who are saying that they pledge allegiance to al-Qaeda. So what's been happening on the ground is that units of the so-called Free Syrian Army have been defecting to units of Jabhat al-Nusra on the grounds that they're a better fighting force. And the idea of arming units of the Free Syrian Army, if that term actually exists, and I doubt it, I think there are thousands of different militias on the ground. The whole rationale is to stop them defecting to other rebels who are jihadis.
And is Washington more cautious?
Intervention.
Is Washington more cautious in fact because of Afghanistan and the Mujahideen and guns ending up in the wrong hands?
Washington's much more cautious, basically because of the whole what the rebels want are Stinger missiles, shoulder mounted weapons which would take down helicopters and aircraft. They also need heavy artillery. And there's a huge problem in Barack Obama's mind about end users. If you pump these arms into a very freewheeling civil war without borders as well, that's the other huge problem that we're facing now. And that is a declaration by the Hezbollah leader that the war that he's fighting in Syria is a war for a Lebanese militia. So you have a civil war raging in Iraq, you have a freewheeling civil war raging in Syria, And you have a very strong possibility of something reawakening, something very unpleasant reawakening in Lebanon. So for regional reasons, I think Barack Obama's caution is quite justified.
And yet, Martin, you have tens of thousands of people who are suffering. And so however hard it is to give effect to, the impulse that says something needs to be done is understandable.
Well, that's true in all circumstances. You know, something should be done is a natural human reflex. I mean, look at what happened in Woolwich in a completely different frame. I mean, you know, this horrible attack a week ago on the soldier, and what happens? You know, people get off the bus and come and try to help and to reason. I mean, there is, I think, without going into too much of a psychological or philosophical thing about it, I think there is a natural human instinct to help, but politically, certainly from the point of view of Britain, you know, what Britain can actually do in the Syrian context is extraordinarily limited for the reasons which David and Jonathan have just gone into.
Isn't there something else as well about public opinion and how hard it is to rally public opinion intervention these
exactly
days?
Exactly so. That's exactly what, I mean, that's the point I was making, because I think, you know, after Iraq in particular and after Afghanistan, and with the continuing loss of life in Afghanistan and the kind of feeling that it's a pointless failure in Afghanistan, the appetite for an intervention in Syria amongst the public in Britain is minimal, just as it is pretty much in America. In some ways, probably America is a bit, the appetite's probably greater because there is that sort of sense of America. Americans have that sense of their indispensability to deal with situations like this. Britain, I think, by and large, has not got that feeling, especially after Iraq and Afghanistan. So I don't think William Hague is answering to a cry behind his back saying, you know, you must intervene, you must do this, you must do that. You know, we cannot stand aside. There's been a bit of that, of course, but I mean, by and large, I think it's much more about Britain, France, the European Union, history, a seat at the table, and those kind of questions. It's not really. It's certainly not about answering to a political demand. And I certainly don't think that a government that is in the kind of domestic difficulties that this one is going to give any priority whatsoever to doing anything that is provocative in a domestic sense.
Although even this business of arming the rebels, I just dug out the opinion poll from a month or two ago on this, 57% against the idea of arming the rebels, against 16% in favour, with the majority against almost as solid amongst Conservative as Labour voters. It hasn't felt like a huge domestic political issue yet, but these things have a way of sliding sometimes, don't they?
Well, they do, but I mean, Britain and France are large arms exporters. There's that bit of momentum, and Britain and France are ex-colonial powers from a century ago in this region, and Britain and France have both are burdened, if you like, by the fact that they wish to be treated as great powers on the global stage and in major international flashpoints. But in practice, they are constrained to some degree by the European Union's reluctance to go further down this line. And I suspect that in reality, there isn't a great appetite for them to get very much further involved amongst the British military either, because they are already having to, you know, they've got enough on their plate. And I think, you know, there are in the senior ranks of the British military many people who are very sceptical about getting drawn into this kind of operation. Certainly, I think our security people UK security people, I think, are absolutely involved in what's going on here. And there's a big sort of security world in Britain which is deeply enmeshed in all of this stuff. But I mean, I think the idea of British troops going into Syria anytime soon is for the birds.
So one reason why Whitehall's very interested and the security services are taking an interest is we always hear this phrase about, you know, regional conflagration, and it's something that we've heard a lot of times, nearly every time there's a flare-up in the Middle East. But do you think there's really the prospect that you could end up with fighting beyond Syria's border, as opposed to, Jonathan, lots of people pouring into Syria to fight there?
Well, I think the two countries, well, maybe three countries that are most affected are Lebanon, Turkey and Iraq. There is already a kind of spillover with Iraq because some of the Sunnis who feel marginalized in Iraq are now inside Syria, because I think they feel the sort of the hour of the Sunnis has come, and you know, we can topple the Assad regime, which is essentially a Shiite regime, and we can get our revenge for what Maliki is doing in Iraq. So there is some spillover into that. So you know, if they get disappointed in Syria, they may return to Iraq and continue, you know, the fight against Maliki or intensify it. So that's one issue. Syria-Lebanon is already a conflict because there are some Lebanese Shia villages inside Syria. They are really Lebanese, and that's partly why Hezbollah is there, to defend those people from the Sunnis in that area who are using it as a corridor to try and get to Homs. And then the Turks are always worried about the Kurdish issue. I mean, one of the reasons why most Kurds are actually backing the Assad government side in the Syrian conflict at the moment is because they do not want Turkey to come in. And if there was a change of regime in Damascus with the Muslim Brotherhood there, who are strong allies of the AKP party that runs Turkey, that would possibly be bad for the Kurds. So they're really worried about that. So, you know, there's spillover on all those three borders. The only one that's relatively secure, and I don't see that being a problem area, is the Jordanian one.
And if we think of this as one of the cases where William Hague's really been at the forefront as opposed to David Cameron, I don't know if that's because it's not a popular issue and Number 10 quite likes the Foreign Office to take up the mantle of this business of selling arms to the rebels. Do you think he's brought anything distinctive to the Foreign Office that we're seeing here? Do you think there's a sort of Hague way of being Foreign Secretary, or do you think it's this policy that we've got in Britain is exactly the same as it would be whoever was in?
Yeah, I don't see anything particular about Hague. No, I think it's more Cameron. I mean, I think one of the points that Martin didn't touch on is that the Libyan experience. I think that David Cameron and the French, Hollande, think that they did well in Libya. They sort of led from the front while Obama was leading from the behind. They think it's a success, although many people would say the Libyan intervention has not proved to be a success because of the chaos now 2 years later in Libya. And so I think he sort of feels we can have now, you know, a second victory in Syria. That's why they're sort of pushing, and they sort of feel we can push Obama into becoming more hawkish. So I think there's an element of that, kind of, you know, letting the British-French tail wag the dog.
But would you accept what Martin's saying, which is, you know, politically troops or maybe even no-fly zones and things like that are kind of off the table anytime soon?
Well, a no-fly zone is not off the table. I think that could still come about, but they would assume that the Americans would be the ones who would run it, as they ran it mainly in Iraq when there was a no-fly zone there and Saddam was still in power. So it's something that they might sort of push for, but expect that the Americans would actually do the hard work if necessary. But I think it's pretty unlikely. But it's more, certainly more of a, or less improbable an option than actually sending British or French or American ground troops, which is really impossible, I think.
And David, how far do you think the relatively recent experience in Libya is conditioning what's happening now?
I certainly think it is a major factor in Putin's calculations. There was recently on the internet a quite well-produced demolition job, really, of the president at the time, Dmitry Medvedev, who was the person who abstained in resolution 1973, which was the no-fly resolution. So his abstention, the Russian abstention, allowed this the no-fly zone to be created. It was done under responsibility to protect. It produced regime change, and there's been a huge backlash in Russia against Medvedev. Presumably, this video was produced by the FSB. It was a real demolition job of how basically this particular Russian acted unpatriotically. Putin is absolutely convinced that he will never allow this to happen again, and his delivery of these very fast anti-aircraft missiles is primarily designed to stop an American no-fly zone over Syria.
OK, well, we will leave that there. There's an awful lot more in the story, far more, obviously, than we can cover in a 15-minute run around the houses. So there's plenty more at guardian.co.uk/Syria. But we now move even further afield to Australia, where we know there are plenty of Politics Weekly listeners who, as of this week, have a dedicated Guardian digital service. Our new political editor is Lenore Taylor, and she joins me now. Now, Lenore, you're very much on election footing ahead of polling day in September. Australia's a bit less battered by the slump than some of the other countries around the world that we're hearing about at the moment. And so for once, there's a possibility that this is an election that's not going to be decided by the global financial crisis, if I understand things right. If that is right, what will it be decided by?
Well, I think the economy will still be a really important issue, but I think this election will really focus around the fundamental issue of trust. We've just had a very volatile term of parliament. The government has had a minority in both houses of parliament. That's for the first time in 30 years. There's been a very aggressive, relentlessly aggressive opposition leader in Tony Abbott. And Julia Gillard, our Prime Minister, is very resilient, very tough. But it's been a really rugged term of parliament. And I think both the attacks by the coalition, by her opposition parties, and also internally the leadership tension that has gone on between her and the person she deposed, Kevin Rudd, those two things together have combined to kind of erode the electorate's trust in her, the electorate's feeling that this is a legitimate government, and the coalition is certainly campaigning on that very hard, and I think that will be kind of the central theme of this election campaign.
And in terms of the state of the horse race, as it were, in the opinion polls at the moment, I think a while ago people were saying Julia Gillard was as good as finished. Does it still look like that in the opinion polls?
Yeah, you wouldn't bet on this horse race because there's only really one outcome that looks likely. Of course, the democratic process will, you know, take its course. But the polls on a two-party preferred basis have been sitting at about 54% for the coalition, 45% for Labor, and they haven't moved. People think they may narrow a bit in the run-up to the election on September 14, but it's very difficult looking at the polls, looking at the trend lines to see how Labor could possibly come back from here, and not many people in the Labor Party think that that's likely either.
You've been catching up, I understand, with Julia Gillard this week, and we'll just hear a little bit of that now.
Whatever the election outcome, do you commit to stay in the parliament and represent the people of Layla for the full term of the next parliament?
Oh, well, I'm obviously running for re-election for my seat.
But that doesn't always mean that politicians stick around. In fact, in many occasions, they haven't. So can you commit that you would definitely stay for the whole next term?
I don't spend time thinking about, the days beyond. Obviously, I spend a lot of time thinking about Australia and public policy and what we need to achieve, but I don't spend time thinking about what would I do as the member for Lawler if. So any of those questions you'd need to ask me sometime after the 14th of September.
But it's not an unreasonable question to ask in the lead up to an election, is it? I mean, we asked it of John Howard in the lead up to the 2007 poll. In fact, I think people in the Labor Party might have encouraged us to ask it of him.
Right. And I don't know, I don't remember what he answered. I suppose he answered that he would stay the member for Bennelong. I don't remember any of that exchange.
I just don't know what your answer is.
Look, I feel an incredible sense of privilege to be the member for Lawler, and I always will feel an incredible sense of privilege to be the member for Lawler, but I am not going to sit here wargaming what would I do if we were in government, what would I do if we were in opposition. I don't spend my time thinking about it, so I couldn't actually give you a thought-through answer. That's not what I spend my efforts doing.
Julia Gillard with you there, Lenore. If people in Britain know anything about her, they're likely to know the things you've already alluded to. You know, first of all, that she's got this very sort of strident relationship with Tony Abbott, with that famous speech about I'm not going to be lectured on misogyny by this man, and also the endless shenanigans around her fraught relationship with her predecessor on the Labour side, Kevin Rudd, all of which indicates she's a rather sort of dogged person. But Has she still got that, if it sounds like she's talking about getting out of politics, even as a possible option?
Well, to be fair to her, the first part of that interview was all about why she thought people should re-elect her and re-elect Labor in its own right so that they could deliver all the things that they want to for Australia. So she wasn't, you know, sort of pulling up stumps and saying, I give up. It was a question right at the end of the interview where I just wanted to know whether she would stick around if Labor lost, because, you know, often prime ministers who lead their party to a loss don't stick around. And really, I only pursued it so hard because she was so evasive about the question. And then the next day, that was picked up in a lot of the other media. And eventually, by about midday, she had to issue a statement and say, no, she would actually serve out the full term of the next parliament, win or lose. You know, I think if Labor loses as badly as it would appear by the current opinion polls, there's probably a lot of the longer-serving politicians that might think about making way for the next generation who would rebuild the party. But Julia Gillard issued a statement saying that wouldn't be her.
So we'll see if that's a sort of politician's answer or not in due course if Labour does indeed lose. How far has she changed the culture of politics? She's your first woman prime minister, isn't she? Has that made an impact? Do you think we're going to see more big-hitting female politicians in future?
Well, I think Julia Gillard has copped so much criticism, such vitriolic attack, that anyone but the most resilient and tough of women, or men for that matter, would think twice about going for the job after what's happened this term. The political culture, I think, has changed this term, but I don't know that it's her doing or just her doing. It's more that we've gone more towards the very sort of personalised, angry, sloganeering kind of political debate that you sometimes see in US presidential election campaigns. It's not that, you know, we'd had a very gentlemanly, you know, genteel kind of political discourse here previously, but I really do think it's shifted. And I don't know if that's because of the politicians who are on the stage at the moment or because we've had this minority government and a feeling of instability around politics for the last 3 years. We've had a particularly volatile term of parliament that has been less focused on policy and calm debate and a lot more focused on politics. And we've also had scandal. I mean, there's been some doozies of scandals this political term as well. You know, a Labor MP who had to become an independent because he was charged with a whole misusing his credit card when he was a union official by going to brothels. There was another one. You know, I mean, there's been scandal after scandal, which has kind of added to this feeling of instability in the parliament. The counter-argument, I guess, which is probably less well-known among voters, is that this parliament's actually succeeded in passing a whole lot of legislation, you know, minority status notwithstanding. But the perception, I think, in the electorate is that it's been a time of tumult.
So you say it's been about personalities rather than policies in terms of how the story's been told, but do you think the Gillard government could be one of those that people look back in years to come and say, oh, actually it did achieve some important things?
It has achieved some important things. Some of them Tony Abbott is vowing to immediately undo. So one important thing that it achieved was to set up Australia's first carbon pricing scheme, starting with a fixed price, moving to an emissions trading scheme. But Tony Abbott says that his first act as Prime Minister will be to repeal that. It is in the process of setting up a national disability insurance scheme, a scheme that ensures that disabled people have the money and the programs that mean that they can have a decent life and their carers can have a decent life. That will be a really major social change for Australia. That one, Tony Abbott has said he will continue with, so that will proceed. There's been the government, there's a schools reform package at the moment which Tony Abbott would also discontinue. So I think of the reforms that Labor has achieved, quite a number of them would be immediately dismantled if the coalition wins in September, as would appear likely.
Lenore Taylor in Canberra there. So my thanks to her, as well as to David Hurst, to Martin Kettle and to Jonathan Steele. I'm Tom Clark. The producer was Phil Maynard, and thanks very much for listening.
more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Do you work in public services? Have you and your team made a difference this year? The Guardian Public Services Awards reward innovation and best practice across all public services. If you're making your sector more innovative, efficient and imaginative, enter now to get the recognition you deserve. For more information and to enter, visit guardian.co.uk/public services awards. The deadline is midnight on Friday the 12th of July. Terms and conditions apply.